To grasp what Italy is all about, ask one of its best-read columnists.
Italy is a fantastic mixed salad.
Beppe Severnini explains what it takes to live like an Italian.
We really smile in spite of everything. That's not always easy.
What is it about certain places that made them a breeding ground for innovation? Eric Weiner compares Renaissance Florence with today's Silicon Valley as he explores a geography of genius.
A dirty little secret about Florentine genius is that it involved money, and we don't normally think of money and genius as having that much in common, but they do.
Rick Antonsen visited a legendary center of scholarship before jihadists and the encroaching desert overwhelmed the history of Timbuktu.
It was mysterious. It was thought of to be having streets paved with gold.
He tells us what he found in the hour ahead. Let's journey together. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Was it something in the air? Eric Weiner traveled to cities that were famous for their great thinkers and innovators. He wanted to see what it was about their surroundings or their social setting that may have stimulated the likes of Socrates, Michelangelo, Leonardo, Beethoven, Freud. People like these who come up with their most innovative ideas and see how it might work for us today. Eric explains in just a bit. And later in the hour, Rick Antonsen tells us about his adventures going all the way to the fabled city of Timbuktu for a haircut. We'll also stumble onto a choir practice in a small town in Wales. By the way, this is episode number 750 of Travel with Rick Steves, and with it, we're celebrating 19 years since airing our very first show. Let's start the hour checking in with Italian journalist and social commentator Beppe Severnini. Beppe says what he noticed about how Italians coped during the pandemic revealed a lot of the wisdom and character of his fellow citizens and how they approach life. He's here to explain. Beppe, welcome back.
Well, it's a pleasure, as always.
You know, connecting with people is key to good travel, as you know well. Part of the joy of being in Italy is just being on a square, being out during the passeggiata and observing. And of course, Italians are famously communicating with their hands and with tiny words. And they've got wonderful phrases, and a couple of little phrases can go a long way. For instance, piano piano. In Italian, you say little by little a lot, don't you?
Piano piano literally means slow, slow. Means, you know, gradually, take it, you know, step by step. But in Italy, we say piano piano. Again, it would be slow, slow.
Slow, slow. How about acqua in bocca?
Acqua in bocca means water in your mouth. It means hush, be quiet, don't say anything. And why? Because if you have water in your mouth, you cannot speak. So acqua in bocca means be quiet, don't say anything.
It's a clever way to just give people some wisdom from time.
Absolutely.
You have a phrase in Italian that might explain how Italians live so well. I don't know the Italian word, but it's like eat well, laugh often, love much. Mangia bene, ridi spesso, ama molto.
Yes, absolutely. It's, you know, they made films and books about it. But I think that, you know, using your heart, amare doesn't mean it's not only a sexual thing or sentiment, or, you know, among lovers, you can love your children, your grandchildren, as we know, Rick. You love your parents. That is love as well. And food is in your sentence as well. Means eating well, not eating much, but eating well. It's important. Italians take a great deal of attention in what they eat, the variety, the texture, the cooking, the times. And I think it's something that people think we are making it up. We are acting. Okay, they want to impress us with their knowledge. No, no, no. You put six Italians around the table, they spend 20 minutes talking about what they have in front of them and possibly what they're going to have in the evening.
When we try to understand Italy through the language, through the way people use their time, through the way people embrace the chaos, and through the way people will have the passeggiata and be together on the streets, it's interesting that there are regional differences in your country. Italy is about the size of California, and there's clearly a north and a south. In fact, in your book, Italian Lessons, you wrote that the north and the south fight like an old married couple. What did you mean about that?
I mean, an old married couple often, hopefully, still love each other, but they cannot help but fighting and discussing and arguing and protesting. And that's what we do. Like, we are married. It's the same with Europe and America. We're married to each other. American can have a fling with Asia or other part of the world. You're married to us. Same thing with Italy, North and South. To be honest, the luckiest part of Italy is the north, where I am from. It's wealthier, and that's unfair, because those differences are present in other countries in Europe. France, Germany, Poland, England, of course. North of England is very different from the south of England, but somehow most of those countries managed to patch it up, to reduce those differences. In Italy, those differences between north and south are still around, and it's a problem.
What are the, if you were to sum it up for people that don't know Italy well, what's the basis of the stress between North and South? How is life different between the North and the South?
Okay, think of you, Rick. You think of three things you really like about Italy and three things you don't like so much about Italy. Okay, the South is times two for all of them.
Yeah. That's exactly right. For years I was telling people, if you like Italy as far south as Rome, go further south, it just gets better. If Italy's getting on your nerves by the time you get to Rome, don't go farther south, it gets worse.
Okay, it's another way of putting it. The south is Italy times two. If we are sort of quick off the mark, they are really quick off the mark in the south. But if we somehow, Italians are unreliable, that's really our weakest point, I think, in terms of, in the south, they tend to be a bit more unreliable than we are, and so on and so forth.
And up in the north where you live, there's that Germanic influence in Lombardy, right, which tempers the Italian.
Yes, probably my background as yours is Norwegian, mine is probably German. We looked up my name, but we're talking 1,000 years. I don't know. My ancestors were farmers in Crema 500 years ago, so probably going back there were German. In Italy, Italy is a mix, is a fantastic mixed salad. You have everything of everyone in the same country as you have in America. That's why when I hear some people say, oh, we want the pure Italian. What, pure what? Italy is a genetic mess, and thanks God for that.
Yeah, well, that's the reason we like to go there. It's unpredictable. Around every corner, you'll find something very entertaining, and it's a work in progress. Beppe Severnini writes a popular column at Italy's largest circulation daily newspaper in Milan. He's giving us a cozy look at how Italians approach life right now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in historic Crema, just outside Milan. Beppe's books in English include Italian Lessons, 50 Things We Know About Life Now, Off the Rail, A Train Trip Through Life, and Ciao America, An Italian Discovers the U.S. Beppe, when I was reading through your book, Italian Lessons, 50 Things We Know About Life Now, it occurred to me I need to update my sidebar in my guidebook about Rome and Milan. I have an out-of-date comparison of Rome and Milan, and in your book you wrote how the longtime rivalry is on pause now, as it seems Rome is no longer as competitive. You've got nieces in Rome, right? And when they come to Milan, they commented to you on what they saw. What did your Roman nieces notice when they came to Milan?
My Roman nieces, my Roman friends of all ages, my Roman colleagues, you talk to all of them, and they'll say, no matter what, that this rivalry doesn't make sense anymore, because Milan is an active, pulsing, growing city, wealthy, with more opportunity, and Rome has got a huge problem in terms of public transport, parking, the condition of the situation on the street, garbage. Garbage is a huge problem, uncollected trash, okay? We're talking about a major European capital, and I'm afraid tourists notice that. And to say this, as an Italian, not as a Milanese, as an Italian, is very painful, but it has to be said. And they somehow, Rome cannot get its act together and solve those two or three things. Public transport and collecting trash. You solve those two and the rest will follow.
Beppe, it's so great to talk with you, and it's so fun to be able to share ideas with somebody who's spent a career as a journalist thinking about what makes Italy so Italian. If you've got friends from the United States visiting Italy, what do you wish they would bring with their visit in the way of attitude to enjoy their time in Italy the most?
Yes, I do have American friends actually quite often coming to see me. Even in Crema, we are now famous for the film Call Me By Your Name was actually set, and the setting was in Crema. So we have a lot of people say, oh, we want to see what the countryside in the summer, ba-ba-bam. So what do I say to my American friends? Two things. Number one, stay in Crema with me a few days and travel and see some of the peace cities. The peace cities are the key to Italy. Parma, Pisa, Padova, Pavia, Piacenza, Perugia, a peace city, Pordenone, you cannot get it wrong. And then, even more important, never, ever a cappuccino after 11 in the morning. It's not only immoral, it's illegal.
Okay, so first of all, review the peace cities again for me. I've got to get this straight on my map here.
Padova, Parma, Perugia, Piacenza, Pavia, Pordenone, Pisa, all of those.
And you know, the great thing about that is Italy is one of the most over-touristed, least explored countries that I know. And none of those cities would be overexposed. Those are places that somebody who thinks they know Italy well has never been to, with the exception of Pisa. And in Pisa, they just go to the Piazza of Miracles with the Leaning Tower, and they didn't even look at the rest of the town. So don't worry about the Leaning Tower. Pisa is a cultural power in itself. So those are your peace cities. You could build a whole itinerary around that. And even if you don't go to Venice, Florence, Rome, and Assisi and Siena, you can learn a lot about Italy. And then why would you not have a cappuccino after 11 o'clock?
It's a dogma. It's immoral and it's illegal and you don't do it, period.
Oh, it's a simple dogma with no basis in logic.
Absolutely. Dogma. Trust me. I'm Italian. Don't do it.
And this relates to the last point. You have 50 points in your book. It's called Italian Lessons, 50 Things We Know About Life Now. And in the very last page of your beautiful book, you say, the last trait of being Italian that you want to celebrate, we smile in spite of everything. And let's face it, that's not always easy. What exactly do you mean there?
Well, I work all my life to come up with that. You read it so beautifully. Actually, do it again. I don't have anything to add. But we really smile in spite of everything. That's not always easy.
That's not always easy. But the Italians, you could be surrounded by all sorts of beautiful chaos, bella chaos. Just smile. And don't have a cappuccino after 11 a.m.
No way. Don't do it. Don't.
Beppe Severnini, mille grazie. Buon lavoro. And complimenti. There are my Italian words.
Grazie mille. A presto.
Ciao. Beppe describes what it was like to teach a few words of Italian to Chinese college students. That's in an extra to today's show. You can hear it at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, Eric Weiner looks at what Renaissance Florence and ancient Athens have in common with California's Silicon Valley. And Rick Antonsen tells us about his trip to Timbuktu, back before Mali became too dangerous to visit. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Eric Weiner calls himself something of a philosophical traveler. He admits to having an obsession for exploring where ideas and places intersect. After a health scare put him in the hospital, he wrote about his flirtation with the divine in his book, Man Seeks God. Eric looked for the happiest places on earth in his follow-up title, The Geography of Bliss. He joins us from our Travel with Rick Steves archives right now to look for the smartest places on earth. In his book, The Geography of Genius, Eric examines what seemed to have turned a handful of places in human history into vital centers of innovation and creativity. Eric, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rick.
So, Eric, tell us about your book. Where does it take us and why?
Well, it starts off with a different theory of genius, right? Because most theories say, well, geniuses are born through, you know, some genetic fluke. Think of Mozart playing the violin at age 3. Or geniuses are made through hard work and sweat, the so-called 10,000-hour rule. But I don't believe either of those really tells the whole picture. I think geniuses are grown in the soil, that the place matters, and it matters a lot more than we think. So that's sort of my starting point. It's starting with what I call these genius clusters that appear around the world throughout history. So in other words, Rick, geniuses don't appear randomly, one in Siberia, one in Bolivia. You know, they appear in clusters, in groups, and that's not a coincidence. So basically, my book sets out to answer two questions. What was in the water back then, and can we bottle it? You know, what lessons can we learn from these genius clusters, and how can we make ourselves, if not geniuses, a little bit more creative?
And we're going to look at the places that you feature in your book here. Just briefly, we're going to review Athens, Florence, Edinburgh, Vienna, and Silicon Valley. And the interesting thing that you've just pointed out is, in each case, it's not one incredible Leonardo da Vinci. It's a whole cluster of people. So going way back to the Golden Age of Greece, this is sort of the first big storm of creativity and genius. Why Athens, and why several hundred years before Christ?
It's a good question, why Athens? Because Athens was only one of several hundred Greek city-states. And if you were a betting person back in, you know, 450 BC, and you were to choose which one would be remembered today as the cradle of so much, you wouldn't really choose Athens. You know, Sparta was more powerful militarily. Other city-states were wealthier, were bigger. Athens didn't have a lot going for it. But what it did have going for it was a sort of outward view of the world, a sort of expansive view. The Athenians were great seafarers, and they traveled far and wide, and they brought back lots of foreign ideas. And as Plato said, and I'm probably going to butcher the quote a bit, but the paraphrase is, what the Athenians borrow from others, they perfect. And the truth, Rick, is they didn't borrow, they stole. You know, and this is one of the great secrets of genius, is that geniuses steal. You know, they are thieves. The Greeks borrowed statue making from the Egyptians and mathematics from other parts of the world. And then, of course, they perfected it. They added their own touch to it.
Okay.
But it was very much a synthesis culture.
So Sparta was sort of the ancient Prussia. Just life was boot camp.
Yes.
And they left nothing. If you go to Sparta, there's very little. But Athens opened to the world, and you can see the results when you've traveled to Greece and go to Athens and stand on that Acropolis. Let's go about 2,000 years ahead now to Florence and the Renaissance. That really means a rebirth to the greatness of the ancients, like the Golden Age of Greece.
Right.
And you think about Florence, and my goodness, I mean, you could think of all these Renaissance greats, these household words of great artists and thinkers and so on, and it's like they went to the same high school at the same time. Give us a review of the class of 1500 at Florence High School.
What a class it was, you know. Can you imagine being at the reunion? So what have you been up to, Michelangelo? Oh, I did the Sistine Chapel. How about you, Leonardo? Oh, you know, nothing much, just a Mona Lisa and so much more. Again, a dirty little secret about Florentine genius is that it involved money. And we don't normally think of money and genius as having that much in common, but they do. Of course, the famous patrons of Renaissance Florence were the Medicis. And the Medicis were loaded. They were like Bill Gates loaded times 10. And instead of just, not that Bill Gates squanders his wealth, but instead of spending it on whatever Gates spends it on or others spend it on, they decided to spend it on art. And they were patrons, but they were good patrons. They knew art, and they knew how to choose talent. Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lorenzo Medici, the most powerful man in Florence at the time, is walking down the street one day near his gardens, and he spots a young stonecutter, not older than 14 years old. The stonecutter's making a statue of a deer, and Lorenzo says, oh, that's very good, but you didn't make the teeth right. The teeth are a young person's teeth, a young deer's teeth, and they should be decayed. The next day, Lorenzo walks by and sees the stonecutter has, in fact, corrected his mistake and done it brilliantly. Lorenzo takes the stonecutter into his fold, into his home, gives him the best teachers, access to the best minds of the day, and that 14-year-old stonecutter is now today known as Michelangelo.
Wow.
That's an example of talent scouting, and that's what the Medicis did. They could spot talent, and they could nurture it.
Nurturing, yes. That sounds...
Yes.
Now, you mentioned, you know, there's just this underlying financial foundation. These are bankers and merchants first who recognize talents, and they were materialists, but not materialists maybe in as crude a sense as they might have been, and they had a taste for the arts and for culture. You know, when I teach people about traveling, there is this reality. If it was wealthy 1,000 years ago, it's got good stuff to see today. If it was poor 1,000 years ago, there's less to see today. I mean, southern Italy, not a lot of great art and great museums. I mean, it's got its charm.
Right.
But you go to places where the money was through Germany, it's the trade route that has all of the great art. And in Florence,
We don't like to think of that. We have this sort of, you know, myth of the starving artist. Starving artists don't produce any art. That's not to say that money is all you need, right?
Because no, but it
helps.
There's
plenty of examples around the world today and in the past of places that were loaded with money but didn't have the taste. They didn't have what the Italians called sprezzatura, which is this great word. It means a squirt of little something extra.
That little something.
And that's
extra.
What the yeah, and that's what the Florentines had. They were very and they still are very discerning people. I think the Florentines would they'd rather miss by a mile than by an inch. They can't stand it if something's a little bit off.
That whole notion that you got to have the financial wherewithal, it even goes back to I think Golden Age Greece, because previously everybody was involved in just subsistence, farming or hunting or gathering. But when you have enough affluence where there's people who can do specialties and people who can sit around and think and make art, then you have that opportunity for maybe that sprezzatura that you're talking about to take hold. Eric Weiner explores creativity through the ages in his book, The Geography of Genius. He's also written The Geography of Bliss, which was adapted into a TV series, and The Socrates Express. Eric's newest title is called Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. In it, he follows Benjamin Franklin from Philadelphia to Paris, Boston, and London for the life lessons we can learn from him. Ben and Me is due to be released this June. You know, one of the surprises for me, Eric, in your book was, I mean, Florence and Athens, yeah, for sure, Edinburgh. For 40 years, you write, Edinburgh ruled the Western intellect. How so?
Well, for this period of, you know, roughly 1760 to 1800, I mean, Edinburgh was where you wanted to be. You had people like Adam Smith, the founder of modern capitalism, and David Hume, a brilliant philosopher, and all sorts of artists. I mean, it really was sparking in every direction, and it was unlikely in that it was, you know, up there, way north on the edge of the world, and this is, you know, before Skype and everything. But the Scots, they were big into education, and they had a huge literacy campaign, the Church of Scotland did, trying to get people to read the Bible, but, you know, they ended up getting people to read a lot more than that, and that sort of got things rolling. It was a very social genius cluster. They all are, but this in particular, it's called the Scottish Enlightenment. Some people joke that it should really be called the Scotch Enlightenment because they drank so much, and they would get together, Rick, in these places, like one was called the Oyster Club. And I went to the spot where it supposedly existed, and it's been resurrected by a very resourceful former rugby player, a Scotsman, who says he's trying to resurrect the old Oyster Club. This is where the likes of Adam Smith would get together every Friday afternoon and eat oysters, which was actually peasant food back then. They wanted to show they were men of the people, and drink just boatloads of claret and some scotch, but they favored red wine back then, and talk about ideas in a very interdisciplinary way. You didn't see the boundaries that you do today. I mean, you would have philosophers and scientists and mathematicians and writers all in the same room, all talking.
Boy, you know, it's very interesting to think, okay, you got John Knox, the great reformer, and translates the Bible or makes sure that people can get their hands on a Bible in their own language, and everybody wants to read. Then you got Adam Smith, considered the father of capitalism, right? And all that industry, but you also have that social ethic. Interesting that you point out in the book so many of America's founding fathers have a connection with Edinburgh.
Yes. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, had studied in Scotland, and often it was a connection with Edinburgh University's medical school, which was one of the first and certainly the best in Europe at the time. As I write in the book, medicine was the digital technology of its day, and Edinburgh was its Silicon Valley. There were amazing advances being made in medicine, and it was, I think, the epitome of Scottish genius, which is ultimately very practical. The Scots were and are very practical. When you think about it, medicine is practical. There's a theoretical side to it, but ultimately it's about helping people and curing people, and that's what they excelled at. And so you had a lot of American students coming over to Edinburgh. Benjamin Franklin visited Edinburgh and, in fact, helped Adam Smith with the early drafts of his famous book, The Wealth of Nations. And Benjamin Franklin also said, hey, I've got some students for you for the medical school. You should check them out. So there was a lot of back and forth, and good ideas are like toddlers. They cannot stay put for long. And and the good ideas of Scotland crossed the Atlantic to the colonies.
Now, another city you feature is Vienna. And Vienna has two distinct golden ages, right? One around philosophy and one around music. Talk about that.
Yeah. It was one of the few places I found that had what I call a double dip of genius. Usually they get one shot out of it and it's all downhill from there. But in Vienna, you know, around 1780, 1790, 1800, you had the musical golden age. You had Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, and Schubert all intersecting in Vienna at roughly the same time. In fact, Haydn was a teacher of both Beethoven and of Mozart. And so he was sort of the glue, the adult in the room. Papa Haydn, they called him. He was the one that held it together. So you had the musical flourishing. And then 100 years later, boom, you have turn-of-the-century Vienna, which is incredible. Probably the best-known figure to come out of that is Sigmund Freud. But you also had the artist Gustav Klimt. You had writers. You had physicists. You had a lot going on in Vienna. And by then, it was a very different city. It was a huge city of 4 million people, a city of immigrants. And that is one of the themes in my book. Genius often thrives on immigration and people from other parts of the world bringing their fresh ideas. Freud himself was an immigrant, never fully fit in, partly because he was Jewish, partly because he was just an odd man. But that's the thing about these places of genius, is there's always a slightly uncomfortable fit between person and place.
Now, the themes of clusters of geniuses getting together and jamming, well, that's certainly the case when you got Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn knowing each other and teaching each other. And I can just imagine the jam sessions they would have had and how that stoked their creativity. And you've got the money. You've got this enlightened sort of patronage by the Habsburgs that helped stoke the music excellence of Vienna.
Yeah. You also had another factor, Rick, which is the audience. You had an appreciative and discerning audience. Music was quite literally in the air in Vienna of 1800. So many people played musical instruments that in apartment buildings, they had to work out schedules for who could practice when so that he didn't disturb one another.
I love it.
The emperor at the time, Joseph, played the violin, played other instruments. So, yes, there was money, but there was an audience that operated on several levels, from the street sweeper who knew his music all the way up to the emperor.
Eric Weiner is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves as we focus on the hot spots for innovation through the ages, which he writes about in The Geography of Genius. His website is ericweinerbooks.com, spelled E-R-I-C-W-E-I-N-E-R. In our age, Silicon Valley comes to mind, and we think of that as the digital revolution, but you wrote in your book that the genius of Silicon Valley has little to do with technology. How so?
Well, we think of it as technology, but really that's just the product of the genius, right? The outcome.
That's right.
But the process is really what I call idea curation, right? In Silicon Valley, there is a system in place, informal system, but still a system for recognizing good ideas, for killing off bad ideas, and for nurturing the good ones. It is a place that is very good at discernment. It's very good at saying, hey, that is worth funding. And the venture capitalists often are the ones who do that. They are, I think, the Medicis of Silicon Valley. They are the ones who are deciding what gets funded and what doesn't. But really, the technology is just the product. It's the process of recognizing good ideas, separating them out from the bad ideas, and then finding a pathway for the good idea, saying you should talk to so-and-so and so-and-so. There are a lot of what sociologists call weak ties in Silicon Valley. People know a lot of people, but they don't know any of them particularly well. And that actually is a formula for creative genius.
You wrote in your book that Voltaire wrote that wealth and freedom is a prerequisite of any golden age. And you also say, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a city to raise a genius. And we've talked about the necessity of having this economic foundation and the freedom and the stability to have a hotbed of genius and creativity. Do you find that's a sort of a common thread as you look at all of these different places?
I do. In fact, I added to Voltaire's wealth and freedom, I added instability to that. There has to be a bit of that. You know, Graham Greene famously mocked the Swiss by saying, you know, 500 years of peace and democracy, and what have they brought us? The cuckoo clock. In fact, it's actually a Bavarian invention, not even Swiss. But the point is, you need to stir the pot wealth and freedom is not enough. You need a degree of chaos, actually. And that was another common thread I found. Chaos on the macro scale, in that some of these places were politically unstable. And on the micro scale, Beethoven's desk, total mess. The man was a slob. And Einstein's as well, and his hair. You know, that's not a man who really needed order in every part of his life.
A couple of thoughts just to sum up, Eric. As we get more interconnected, does the geography matter less?
You know, is Silicon Valley sort of the last place of genius? Is that your question? In other words, because they've created this interconnected digital world.
Yeah, maybe that's the irony of their genius, is that we're all interconnected
right now.
And maybe there's still that genius, but it's dispersed. It just seems like the geography is so interesting.
I don't think that's true. I think, you know, why do all the people, all these prophets of a placeless future, you know, all happen to live in one place, which is Silicon Valley? Why does that continue to exist? They tell us, well, we could be in Montana, we could be in Estonia, we could be anywhere, but they're not. They hang out in the same coffee shops, they ride their expensive bicycles on the same country roads, and there is still something about place that matters very much. One person told me that every iPhone is like a breadcrumb that leads to Silicon Valley. Young, bright people studying digital technology in China or India, and they get their iPhone. Where do they want to go? They want to go and work in Silicon Valley.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Eric Weiner, and his book is The Geography of Genius. And Eric, I've got to say, it is so stimulating just to read about all of these incredible, perfect storms of genius.
Do you feel a bit more genius-like now, Rick?
I feel a little more wonderstruck by places that have that whatever is. What was that word in Florence?
Sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura, that little something extra. So, Eric, thank you so much, and
pleasure.
Best wishes.
Thank you so much, Rick.
We head for Timbuktu before stopping in for a choir practice in Wales. That's all next on Travel with Rick Steves. I once stood atop a massive sand dune south of the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, looking across a vast and empty desert. Standing there, I marveled at how remote we were, and my guide said, "Yes, the next stop is Timbuktu," literally. I skied down that dune on my heels, and we returned to our jeep and headed back to the village I was calling home. That's as close as I ever got to Timbuktu. But about 20 years ago, Rick Entenson actually trekked there, across the desert, with his Malian guide, Zach. He wrote a book about his experience, and the book is called To Timbuktu for a Haircut. And right now, Rick Entenson joins us to reminisce. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Oh, nice to be a part of a conversation with you always.
So this is something. If you look at the map of Africa, there's a landlocked country called Mali. And if somebody lives there, it's called a Malian?
Yes.
Malian, okay. And you had this guide, Zach, and you were trekking to the mysterious city of Timbuktu. I love how you write about sleeping on rooftops of mud houses under those vast African skies. Tell us, just to set the table here, what was this trek? How far was it? How long did it take? Tell us what you did.
So getting to Timbuktu was something that, as a kid, we would always say, "Daddy, Daddy, where are you going?" I'm 5 years old. I'm 6 years old. "Daddy, Daddy, where are you going?" He would always say, whether he was going to church or to work, or he would say, "I'm going to Timbuktu to get my hair cut." That's what he would say. So as an older, you know, traveler, I wanted to go to Timbuktu to get my hair cut. That was the motivation. Simple as it sounds, off I was going. Zach became my guide. And now, two decades later, we're still in touch once every couple of months. He's had to move around a lot because of the danger of being in Mali. You and I wouldn't go to Timbuktu today. We would be kidnapped bait. It would be very dangerous. But then, while it was awkward and had some dangers, it was a fascinating place to travel to. In the desert, it used to be known as the most remote place on Earth. It was mysterious. It was thought of to be having streets paved with gold. Gold would come from the south in Africa to trade with salt from the north, from the Sahara, and they would trade a pound for a pound. A pound of gold for a pound of salt.
Holy cow, isn't that something?
Ounce for ounce, weight for weight.
It's hard for us to imagine, before Europeans named Africa the Dark Continent, that it was a thriving continent that rivaled and even surpassed Europe in a lot of cultural things. And Timbuktu was sort of a legendary city, a trading center. that in trade was on par with London or even Venice. And today, there's very little left of that. And I'm just curious, what it was like for you on your trek to approach Timbuktu, that fabled town, and finally enter it after so many memories of your dad saying, I'm going to Timbuktu to get a haircut. You're coming into town. What was that like?
I was, I think, fighting my own expectations. Part of me wanted it to look like what I imagined in the 1400s. Part of me wanted to see some insights of, gosh, this was such a celebratory place, when in fact it evokes poverty and needs.
And you even wrote, Timbuktu does not long to be loved. It shrugged at my arrival.
It was indifferent.
That was a great line. That was a great, here I am. Where's my haircut?
Exactly.
You know, and exactly. No fanfare. It was just a dusty town. 50,000 people still, I understand.
It's now closer to 10,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
10,000 to 15,000.
Well, that must be the result of desertification. I mean, talk about a sad story now, especially considering its amazing heritage, crippled by poverty, ravaged by terrorists and civil strife, and with this rising tide of sand under 100-degree heat every day.
Well, and trees that used to be nearby, or foliage that grew up around the river, a lot of that has been taken for firewood or taken for other uses. So there's nothing to hold the earth in place. So it moves with the wind, and the wind is bringing sand. So that is very difficult. It's difficult breathing. Because this used to be French West Africa, they've got sort of the culinary legacies. The bread in Timbuktu is fantastic. And there are ovens on the streets where they're making wonderful bread. But as you eat this gorgeous tasting bread, you're very conscious that you're also chewing on sand.
Now, sadly, the situation for visitors, for tourism, is zero, because the United States has said it's not safe to go there. I doubt if there's any tourism there right now. It's just too dangerous if you're kidnappable or if you're not a jihadist. Do you think much about that when you think back about your visit? I mean, it must be sort of heartbreaking to consider, you know, what happened to the town? What happened to Zach?
And Zach will still do some guiding. He's done different things to try and make his living. But you're right, the jihadists have come in. They were the ones that tried to destroy the town and tear down some of the mosques and do devastation. So Zach, who doesn't live in Timbuktu but nearby, has had to move to other parts of Mali. Right. He actually had to leave the country for a while with his young family to find employment.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're joined by Rick Antonsen. And he's written Route 66 Still Kicks after taking the ultimate American road trip. He's written The Train Beyond the Mountains after journeying across Canada on that wonderful train there. And he's written a book about his adventures in Timbuktu. It's called To Timbuktu for a Haircut. To learn more about Rick's writing and his work, you can go to his website. It is rickantonson.com, A-N-T-O-N-S-O-N. Now, Rick, I understand the reason for your visit, along with finding that haircut that your dad always talked about, was your fascination with historic manuscripts. And Timbuktu, by some amazing circumstance, has all of these riches in manuscripts, centuries-old manuscripts, in a landlocked place that's suffering from a rising tide of sand. What's the reason that Timbuktu has all of these manuscripts, and why are they so important to you?
Timbuktu was a center of trade. Even though Europeans didn't know where it was, Africans did. And Africans would come from hundreds and hundreds of miles away to trade salt for gold. The other thing that they were said to trade in was ink. And the rationale behind that statement is that they had benevolent governance that created a number of madrasas, a number of universities. So they had at one point like about 23 universities. And if a camel caravan came in the 1400s or the 1300s or the 1500s, among what they carried would be manuscripts, early versions of a book. And they would detain it until they copied every manuscript or document.
So this was a requirement? If you came in, you had to let your manuscripts be copied?
And you wouldn't know that until you got there. But you would be detained until all of them were copied.
And they were hungry for this information before there was anything even hinting at Google.
Absolutely. And they would duplicate these. And so most of them would be in Arabic, some were in Hebrew, but they would keep these. And now here we are hundreds of years later, where there are hundreds of thousands of ancient manuscripts in Timbuktu today.
This reminds me of Alexandria in Egypt.
Yes, about their library.
And every boat that docked in Alexandria, the great port at the mouth of the Nile, had to give up its books so they could be copied. They didn't take the books. They copied them. And then they put that book in the Library of Alexandria, which is the greatest library of the ancient world. And here in Timbuktu, we got the same thing going on.
Right, except for the challenge of the deterioration, because these are old, sand is getting at them, the periodic weather temperature changes, all of these. Plus, some of them are still in people's homes. They've been there for centuries. And these documents can be everything from what we would call a manuscript to perhaps a legal document to perhaps one sheet of paper that was about a wedding ceremony with marginalia written down. But not everybody could read and write in those days, of course.
Right.
And it was said that those who could, as scholars, read and write, they were said to travel the Ink Roads.
The Ink Roads.
I love the term.
As you mentioned, ink was right there with salt and gold as a treasure to trade.
As a value, absolutely.
Information was power.
Well, and the insurgents tried to burn a number of the manuscripts 10 years ago because they wanted to get rid of that knowledge.
Yeah. Rick, it seems like a motive for you was to raise awareness of this and rally society to recognize that this is a cultural treasure that is at risk. What is the status of these beautiful manuscripts right now?
I'm in touch with Abdul Wahid, who runs a bibliothèque, Mohammed Tahar, and I've supported some of his endeavors to preserve manuscripts, to get them in proper boxes, to help people give them up from their homes so they can be preserved. During the time of the jihadists coming in, there was a big effort by some of the librarians to get the manuscripts, some of them, to better safety in Bamako, in the capital of Mali, which itself is an awkward place to travel.
Does Mali have a government that gets the importance of that?
Yes, and the United Nations, various efforts, some of the universities, a university from Norway, have been quite involved in trying to preserve these. They want to get them all, of course, digitalized. But even separating the pages can collapse the pages because they're that fragile. So it takes great effort. But there are stories, there's information, there's dialogue, there's data that if it doesn't get preserved, it will be lost to us forever because these are one-offs.
You know, Rick, you have learned so much in your travels and you've put so much energy into sharing it. I love the way you write. And from reading your book, it's clear that Mali has a special place in your heart. You wrote that, "In all my travels in Mali, I never found despair. Hardship, disappointment, poverty, indifference, and resignation were always evident, more so even than hope, but never despair." Talk about that for a sec.
I met a fellow who actually was a pilot in the Air Force, and we happened to be getting on a plane when I was leaving. And I talked a bit about this, and he said, you know, yes, people are poor, but they are happy. They are happy. They have subsistence economies. They trade for what they need. They are a really enjoyable people to be around. And they were who they are, and they welcomed you for who you are. And there was no angst. Where I traveled, they had food and friends and family. And in that way, no despair.
Rick Antonsen, your experiences remind me that when we get out and travel, out of our comfort zone, we realize this planet is filled with joy and love and beautiful people. You know, without romanticizing poverty, I think it's important for us here in the privileged first world with unthinkable wealth on a global scale to remember that half of humanity is trying to live on $5 a day and 10% of humanity is in extreme poverty, trying to live on $2 a day. And it sounds like Mali is in that zone of $5 a day, which, as you said, can be filled with joy. And of course, there's challenges. But if we could just overcome conflict, and if we can just have stability, and if we can just realize that this world is home to billions of joyful and loving people, and we can do that through travel, this world could be a better place. We could go to Timbuktu and enjoy a good haircut.
And I could recommend a barber.
Thanks for being with us, Rick. Best wishes in your travels.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that Mali is one of the rare countries to receive a Level 4 Do Not Travel warning from the U.S. State Department. Even its African neighbors have cautioned against traveling there due to the high level of violent crime and kidnapping of foreigners in the years since Rick Antonsen traveled there. While venturing around Wales, my colleague, Cameron Hewitt, came across one of its most delightful traditions one evening, listening to a community choir practice in a small town with a difficult-to-pronounce name.
On my first night in Wales, I had dinner at a cheap little Thai restaurant in Cardiff. Suddenly the lights went out and everyone around me started singing Happy Birthday, but in Welsh. Penblwydd hapus i ti. I'm Cameron Hewitt, and one of the things I really enjoy about traveling in Wales is hearing the Welsh language. It's the first tongue of many people in this corner of the UK, but travelers might not even realize how many people speak it. The Welsh people are such skilled code switchers, they automatically toggle to English for tourists. When I'm in Wales, I challenge myself to tackle Welsh pronunciations. For example, a double L sounds roughly like tla, and a double D is a hard the. Outsiders never quite master it, but the Welsh do appreciate when we try. Tonight, I want to be a fly on the wall of Welsh culture. That's why I'm heading to the little North Wales village of, I think it's pronounced Pwllglas? P-W-L-L-G-L-A-S. Pwllglas. The local community choir, the Côr Ruthun, is having its weekly Thursday night practice. I'm not sure I'll be able to find the Pwllglas Village Hall, but my B&B owner reassures me that it's only a one-street village. He says, just look for where all the cars are parked, and if you pop out at the far end of the village, you've gone too far. Sure enough, you can't miss the village hall. It's the one with the full parking lot out front. As I step out of my car, I can already hear the choir warming up through the open windows. And once inside, they greet me warmly and tell me to pull up a chair. They're working on a brand new song, lots of starting and stopping. The director is wiry, salt-and-pepper-haired, and energetic. He plays the piano with gusto, coaxing a better and better performance out of his choir. I've had good choir directors, and I've had bad choir directors, and he's definitely a good one. And even trying out this song for the first time, they sound great. The lyrics are all in Welsh, and so is all of the instruction and all of the conversation between the songs. Not a word of English. It's a little mind-bending. I'm less than an hour's drive from England, but linguistically, I feel like I might as well be in Mongolia. When the director comes over to chat with me at the break, I'm kind of surprised that he speaks perfect English. He introduces himself with the proper Welsh name of Robert Arwin. He says they're always happy to have observers sitting on the rehearsals because having an audience makes them perform better. I ask why it's important for them to sing in Welsh, and immediately I realize this is a stupid question in Wales.
Well, for us, we're all Welsh-language people, first language, and that's my first language, that's everybody's first language in the choir, so it makes sense that we sing in Welsh.
Okay.
There's lots more choirs in Wales that sing in English.
He rushes back to his piano for the next piece. It's Hail Holy Queen, that Latin Motown mashup from Sister Act. The Latin bits are still in Latin, but the normally English lyrics are in Welsh. Then they move into a more traditional Welsh song, this one with an even more exotic sound. Over the course of the 90-minute rehearsal, the sky outside fades from blue to pink to purple. And as I listen, I look out the windows at slate rooftops and bald mountains. And I realize that here I am experiencing something few other travelers get to. I'm not only enjoying a fine concert, I'm fully immersed in the culture of Wales.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves Guidebook to Italy has long been America's best-selling guidebook to any destination in Europe. We've just updated it, and it's in its 27th edition, and it's ready and raring to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. Pick up a copy at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com.